Good afternoon. This is Debbie Q with The Right Show. The Right Show is a podcast about all things strange and unusual, especially in reference to a death. And today, there are 10 deaths that we're going to be talking about. There's so many things I want to say beforehand. Number one, Philly is becoming the Wild Wild West, as now even South Street, June 4th, 2022, 14 people were shot, 3 people died in the South Street Massacre, as it's being called already. I mean, this is crazy. This is just nonstop shooting all the time. I don't know what's going on. It's just a mess. The gun violence is just outrageous, and it really doesn't matter where you are. It just, and any kind of violence, guns, knives, whatever. Also, I am still doing fucking Philadelphia. It wasn't as many cases left, but there was a few, and I will do, like, because I don't want to sing my song on, like, something like this, because this story that I'm about to tell you today is absolutely tragic. It's the story of Marino. N-O-E was how you spelled it, and she's a real piece of work. I didn't know too much about this case. I knew Marino. Here, I'll say how it says it in the blurb on Wikipedia. Marino was an American woman who was convicted in June 1999 of murdering 8 of her 10 children. Between 1949 and 1968, 8 of the 10 known children died of mysterious causes that were attributed to sudden infant death syndrome. 2 other children did die of natural causes. No pleaded guilty in June 1999 to 8 counts of second-degree murder. I won't tell you what she received right now, because I'll just tell the story first. But, you know, reading that and knowing that, it's like, oh my God, I know the whole story. But Marino was very odd. She was an odd person. I don't know what inspired such anger in her. It seems like to do what she did, you have to have a lot of anger inside of you, because she did more than just kill her kids. Like, she was violent towards animals too. She was basically a serial killer. I mean, seriously, it just doesn't matter that those kids were 6 months old or 2 days old. They were her children. As a mother, you would think that you would be, I'm a mother. I had kids. I know how it is when they're crying all the time. You know, you'd go crazy. I get that. I get being frustrated. But as a mother, your also biggest concern is to protect the physical well-being of your kids, of your children. So I don't understand. I really don't, because you're going against natural reflexes. You know, innately, I think women are born, and I mean, we're the ones that have children. And I think that we have that feeling of, you know, nurturing, and I just cannot see how, I can imagine, like, if you're frustrated, your hormones are all crazy. Like, for example, the woman in Texas, Andrea Yates, when she killed her 5 kids, that was completely different. She was she was under postpartum psychosis. I mean, maybe Marino was too, each and every time. I mean, that's interesting when I just thought of that, because there was more sympathy towards Andrea Yates. Andrea Yates was a Texas woman who killed 5 of her children in a bathtub. But when she had her 3rd child, her doctor told the husband, because she was going into deeper and deeper psychosis each time she had another child. And the doctor said, like, she cannot have another child. She will lose it. And, you know, so the husband should have been there and been protective and, like, at least do that. So she had a chance to see Andrea Yates. Like, there was just a lot more sympathy towards Andrea Yates than, like, to a Susan Smith or a Diane Downs, who were just out and out evil women who killed their kids and really didn't seem to have remorse at all. Marino was on a whole other level. I mean, she bore 10 children, and all 10 of them died. I guess two were said to have died natural causes, but I don't even know if I believe that. I think that wacky old woman killed all of them. But the story itself is weird, and that's the story I'm going to talk about today. I did want to mention, so I don't, when I, once I get started, I can't even, I get into this zone. Marino was born August 23rd, 1928, and she passed away May 5th, 2016. So she was alive until 6 years ago. At the age of 87, she passed away. I'm not sure when Arthur died, her husband, because he was oddball too. He died 2009, so he lived a pretty long life. He died at age, God, my math is so bad anymore. He was like 88? 88, wow. So they lived to be long, old buzzards. Strange, strange people. Also, Stephen Freed was the one who broke the case. Stephen Freed is an investigative reporter, and he was actually also the one who wrote the book Thing of Beauty about Gia Carangi, the model. I just adored him since he wrote about Gia. I just love the way he wrote about it. I mean, that became a movie with Angelina Jolie. He was the one who broke the case of Marino. He was interviewing her because Philadelphia Magazine had put out Medical Mystery or Murder, 10 Dead Babies. Don't Tell My Husband was in one Philadelphia Magazine. Cradle to Grave, another one. Cradle of Death, written by John Glatt. And he really paints a picture, my friends. And it's quite interesting. But so because that is such a heavy subject I'm doing today, I won't be singing fucking Philadelphia. But don't worry, it hasn't died. And I will think up another variation very shortly. Now let's move on to Marino, because this is a long motherfucking story. And I'm shortening a lot of it because there's some stuff I just, wow. I mean, this story is nuts. You know, I have to say I did use, because it was so excellent, Cradle of Death by John Glatt heavily, because Marino doesn't have a lot of stuff written about her, except for old articles of Philadelphia Magazine. And I believe that, you know, at the time, because this came out a while ago, this book, I think he probably was involved in that or used that or whatever, because all of it, it just stems from that time. And I think everything got written around that time, because there really is, like, sometimes you'll read a story or, like, you'll get several sides, like the Maura Murray story, which I'm dying to do. You'll get several different sides, or at times this came out and then this came out. Well, with Marino, it's such a strange story, and I don't know how many people know of it, because it came out, so to speak, in the 90s. I mean, even though she did it in the 50s and 60s, at that time, crib death was very much accepted and misunderstood. So they just were like, don't bother her, that poor woman. She just has very bad luck. But as they realized that crib death, you know, it's not going to happen 10 times in a row. It won't even happen twice, very rarely. It's not familial. Crib death is a freak accident. So they knew that she was doing something. And the neighbor said, we always thought she was freaky. So it wasn't like this big crazy thing that no one knew about. Point is that everything came out in the late 90s when her trial was. This book came out, I think, in 2006, no later than that. Marie was still very much alive, and Arthur was still alive in 2006. And everything came out in that era. I don't see too much after that. That's why the book, it's no different than anything else. Like, everything that I read about her is in a heavily agreement. I mean, she admitted to these murders. The one thing that she does a lot that drove me insane is when they would ask about each baby, she would either say, oh, yes, I strangled them, or, oh, I don't really remember. I don't think I did anything to that one. I think that was a bunch of bullshit. I think she killed every single one of those kids. I really do. All 10 of them. Two, I guess maybe they proved that were died naturally. I don't know if I believe or not. I think she killed every one of them. She was a weird lady. And, well, I'll get to that. I did read that she, if you invite her to a party and there was a baby there, she actually was caught doing weird things or trying to do weird things with other people's babies. So that's when I think the neighborhood kind of probably turned against her. I am saying all this stuff beforehand, but I will get into the whole story now. Here we go. Little segue. I like my little song. Break. This is Debbie Q with the Right Shoe. Okay. Now, on August 5th, 1998, at the time, our Philadelphia district attorney was Lynn Abraham. Now, she was tough as nails. She did run for mayor, I think, in 2015. The reason she didn't win or the reason she kind of got kicked to the curb, she was a tough prosecutor. I mean, she was tough as nails. But she was very pro-cop, and she made a statement that pissed off a lot of people. And even when I talked to Homicide, they were like, oh boy, did she really fuck up? Like when she was running for mayor, apparently they were talking about cops who get away with stuff. And she didn't even like try to hide her feelings. She was just like, well, when I was a prosecutor, you just didn't do that. Like, meaning I would never prosecute a cop. So it did not go over well. And every cop I talked to was like, she just kind of fucked herself out of the mix. Because this is a heavily Democratic city. And then you're going to say something like that. I don't even know if she made it out of the primaries. I know she did not make mayor. I guess, you know, and that was different times too. You know, talking in the 90s. Yeah, you got to go by a case-by-case thing with that. Because right now, oh my God, everything's such a fucking mess. Whatevs. So, okay, let's move on. Lynn Abraham gets this mystery that confounded the city for 50 years. It was a tragedy. And she was like, you know, America's deadliest DA, blah, 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 blah. She was going to take on 8 babies. Although she had 10, I guess 2 did have natural deaths. 8 babies from a single Philadelphia family who died mysteriously between 1949 and 1968. It did defy explanation. And the police, because back then in the 60s, crib death was completely misunderstood and everyone was sympathetic towards Marino at that time. They didn't prosecute, but by the 90s, they realized there was something going on. So now she was brought, it seemed like she lived in Kensington her whole life. I do not know why in the John Glatt book, it says the tough Philadelphia suburb of Kensington. It's in Philadelphia. I don't know if that's a misprint or Philadelphia neighborhood of Kensington. That's one of the biggest neighborhoods. If you look at pictures of Marino, younger pictures, she's not a bad looking woman, but man, older pictures. And this is another thing that I've noticed. When you do bad, when you're like a bad person inside, whatever you do inside, if you're a good person or if you're a bad person, whatever you do will show on your face. I truly believe this. Marino had this haunted look, as they say. It was haunted because I believe after killing all those children, it started showing up on her face. Gave birth to her first child, Richard Allen, who weighed a healthy 7 pounds, 11 ounces. 1 month later, Marie's husband, Arthur, came home to find the baby dead in his crib. Richard's death was the beginning of this tragic event that would multiply itself. Because incredibly, after that, 8 died in unexplained circumstances, some surviving more than 15 months, many dying within weeks of their birth. She was featured in Life, and the writer for Life, her name is Marie Cadwalader, I believe that's how you pronounce her last name. She interviewed Marie for this magazine, and she said her lack of emotion really made her question how much of it, you know, how much she was behind the deaths of her own children. People in the neighborhood and friends, close friends, said that they stopped hanging around with them. Although they were nice to children and they were nice, pleasant to talk to, it just started freaking them out. So at some point, Marie had a hysterectomy, but man, she had gave birth to 10 kids. And by the 90s, the multiple SIDS death was debunked. That's when all the problems started for Marie. In March of 1998, Marino finally broke her silence to confess that, yes, she was behind it. And she did confess. You know, they go back, they show, like, Marie's upbringing was not good. She lived with her parents were James Liddy and Ella, the mom and dad. And they, you know, James drank, and it just seemed like they had a very volatile relationship that did not bode well for Marie growing up. And she, you know, not at one point she was able to go with her grandparents in Florida, and she loved it. It was like a respite, but 9 times out of 10, she was with her parents, and she just didn't do well there. She didn't flourish. She was a sullen child. I mean, not when she was away from them. She was fine when she was away from her parents. And actually, she became quite promiscuous as a young adult. Whether that was to get away from her parents or not, I'm not sure. She did meet Arthur Young. They met at like a dance. Arthur was not, like, he didn't get women or nothing. He was kind of like a shy little guy. He wasn't like the best looking dude. So painfully shy. He never had a girlfriend, and he was obsessed with losing his virginity. He started drinking, you know, to kind of get up the courage. Linda Harris was somebody who would become Arthur's friend, but she would also become Marie's friend through Arthur, ultimately not talking to either of them after she said, "I really was highly suspicious of Marie from the beginning after all those crib deaths." And she's like, "I just didn't want to talk to either of them." So she was a friend, Linda Harris, for a long, long time. I believe that's a pseudonym. She did call Arthur a pathetic little man, always bemoaning the fact that he couldn't get girls interested in him. One day, they were at a club, the Coopersville Club. Arthur was very entranced with this young, slender, blue-eyed blonde. She was taller than him, but he asked her for a dance. Marie was who the girl was, and they fell in love. They would get married, you know, not too much longer after, June 1st, 1948. And they moved to, I guess they moved in with Arthur's parents because they couldn't afford their own place at first. It was on Atlantic Street. I think it was Lower Kensington or Kensington. Kensington proper. Arthur, you know, he seemed like an okay guy. Marie, I think she had a couple marbles loose. She had a bout with scarlet fever when she was little, and they say after that she kind of like was almost slow. Marino was slow, so Arthur taught her how to read, how to talk. He was very proud of this. She became pregnant. Arthur's mom never really liked Marie, and I'm sure this after that, I mean, after all these kids, I'm sure she didn't like her even less. And also, I wanted to say, in early 1949, Marie often liked to be center of attention. I think that's why she was promiscuous as a teenager. But then she began crying rape. One night when she was 7 months pregnant, she went to sleep and waited for Arthur to come home. She said she had awakened by a colored man. These were her terms. with a limp, wearing a leather jacket, who broke in through an open door and brutally raped her. Although she maintained that she put up a struggle and bit her attacker's ear, her father-in-law, who was asleep upstairs, never heard a thing. When Arthur arrived home, he found her in a state of panic, screaming for police, saying that she had been raped. She was taken to Temple University, which was nearby. I don't know, her sister said it shook her up pretty bad. The Bulletin, which was the big paper in the city for many years, it was like 80, I think, when it stopped. She, her story changed multiple times, and nobody outside of her close, like nobody close to her believed her. They just didn't. So 2 weeks later, she returned to Temple University and gave birth to a healthy 7-pound, 11-ounce baby boy named Richard Allen. She was in labor for 12 hours, and her baby suffered a little abrasions, but it was a beautiful, bouncing baby boy. Arthur took out $100 Prudential Life Insurance. They went home. Now, they said right away, Marie seemed melancholic and indifferent to motherhood. She refused to feed her new son after birth. They noted that Arthur was far more comfortable holding the baby. 5 days later, he was discharged. He had jaundice, but doctors reassured Arthur and Marie that this was normal. Marie became convinced there was something wrong. He was sickly. He was throwing up and had loose bowels. Over the next few days, the baby didn't gain any weight. She called her sister Frances. Frances, who had lost a child 5 years earlier, came over and said he did look ill. Maybe he has colic. So she took him back to Temple. Marie did. Eventually, the doctor said there really isn't anything wrong with the baby except the colic. But Marie, who obviously could not stand the crying, began to resent the baby. She longed for Arthur to come home and feed Richard and change his diapers and relieve her of the responsibility. She would pace up and down the living room, getting more and more angry. He kept crying. Finally, she said she felt an increasing compulsion to silence his cries. The night that Arthur was working his 3 p.m. to midnight shift, she was often home alone with the baby. She bathed and dressed him one night in his nightclothes, placing him on his back in his bassinet at the end of the bed. He began crying louder, and Marie just could not take that sound. She picked him up, turned him over, faced him down in the pillow. Placing her hand over the back of his head, she used all of her strength to drive his tiny face into the soft bedding and waited for him to die. When he obviously was not alive anymore, she relaxed her grip. For the first time since his birth, Marie felt whole again. She laid down next to him and waited for her husband to come home. He came home. They had a funeral for him. There was no grounds for suspicion. An autopsy was not even performed. They put down congestive heart failure due to subacute endocarditis. Marie, who had been stoic, now looked happy and zestful again. So they were very, I don't know. She seemed almost cheerful at the funeral. It's weird. Marie also would have these, when she was close to her period, she would have these attacks where she would go blind. She had issues. She even blamed Arthur for her blindness, saying that he had flown into a rage the night before, refusing to permit her to have another child because she said she wanted one. She complained that the marriage had been under great strain and she was postpartum. Her family doctor had forbidden sex until further notice. That was the only thing preventing her from leaving Arthur was money. She feels like a stranger with her husband. It just seems like she was really had a lot of hormones flowing and a lot of emotions. And this didn't do well because after this first pregnancy, she would continue to get pregnant again and again and again. And her mother-in-law said she always knew something was up with her. Now, back then, the neighborhoods were different. They were very tight, very close. So if somebody's baby died, like the whole neighborhood was there for you. This is around the time she developed a crush on a neighbor. She admitted to having an affair. She felt so guilty afterward that she owned up to it to Arthur, who was furious. And he said, you better go get checked out for sexually transmitted diseases or I won't forgive you. I mean, this is the kind of shit going on in that marriage. She would finally give birth to Elizabeth Mary. Arthur would get out another life insurance policy, which each subsequent baby, the life insurance policy would go up and up. Elizabeth was good until she got a cold, Marie would say years later. Then she got cranky. And that's what would happen time and time again. When these kids would start to get cranky or display any sense of emotion, Marie would be there to strangle them or do something to them, smother them. And what she admitted to was smothering or strangling. But she would do it in such a way that they couldn't really see it. She was fussing. The 5-month, 9-day-old baby was bigger and stronger than her brother had been and put up a desperate fight for her life when Marie tried to smother her. She said it took all of her strength. I held the pillow over her face until she stopped moving, which is so disturbing. I mean, you know, smothering somebody is hard. Killing somebody that way is difficult. That's why, they said, like, usually people who do that, they know somebody. Like, when somebody's strangled, they usually say the killer, not most often, knows that person because it's an intimate killing. Now, in the 1950s, the Philadelphia Medical Examiner's Office was primitive. Even they said Dr. Dimitri Constantavos said suffocating a baby was the perfect murder because we cannot detect it. And there's nothing we can say. Like, you can't say, no, it didn't happen because it's so bizarre. They couldn't say anything, especially back then. Because maybe that's, you know, you react differently. It was tough back then. It was easier to get away with that kind of stuff. Not that I still, like I said in the beginning, it baffles me because that's like your motherly instincts. It goes against everything. She said she would try for another baby. They moved to Ontario Street. They would move because they said they didn't want the bad luck. She got pregnant again. He said, don't worry, everything will be fine. And she said, I wish I could be certain. Next baby is born April 23rd, 1952 at Episcopal Hospital, 7 pounds, 2.5 ounces. The hospital staff said Marie was totally disinterested in her daughter. So sad. And this went on and on. I mean, now, this is where it gets, like, I hate to say tedious, but it's the same story over and over and over again. Another healthy boy, April 23rd, 1955, Arthur Jr. This time, they took out a $1,000 insurance policy. 5 days, he had been home when his mother rushed him back, complained that he was having difficulty breathing. The doctors couldn't find anything and gave him a clean bill of health. So he was healthy when she would get these babies. Another baby girl, February 24th, 1958. 7-pound, 8-ounce baby Constance. She chose a new hospital, saying she did not want to be reminded of the past. Now, Dr. Abraham Perlman was a young pediatrician. He had known nothing about the previous 4 babies and their deaths. Marie said to this doctor, because he was looking over her and saying, you know, the baby's fine. She said, what's the use? She's going to die just like all the others. This doctor was so shocked by her reaction that he ordered, like, extra tests because he wanted to make sure, like, what's going on. While they were alone, Marie later claims, this is what she claimed in when they finally caught her and brought her in for questioning in the 90s. She said, I placed the tiny baby on a chair in the parlor. I arranged one pillow behind her and set another chair in front of her so she wouldn't topple over. Constance began to cry, and I lost control. I don't know why, but I took the pillow and laid her down in the chair, and I suffocated her. In a dreamlike state, she would carry Constance to her crib and close her eyes if she was asleep. Then she left the room and went upstairs to the bathroom to compose herself. She would remain there until she heard her husband come through the front door. He would come in, freak out. I believe when I read this book, like, initially, I think author didn't know what was going on. And then after a while, I just, because he did seem genuinely upset, but I think he never would leave Marie. And I think he always dearly loved her. I don't know whether he chose to believe her or whether he really didn't, but just didn't want to think that about his wife. I don't know. He stood by her the whole time. He always had a cigarette dangling out of his mouth. I just can't believe that. That's scary. Now, not only was the babies dying, but they had like cats, dogs, fish, birds, and they would all die. So this, you know, Marie was like killing anything alive that came into that house, which is really disturbing. Now, her mother said she was just devastated by all this. She was all filled up inside. She couldn't, you know, she didn't want to go home. They moved a couple times because they wanted to try to break their luck. I mean, this is her family talking. I'm sure her family didn't want to believe that Marie did all this, but it's just, you know, and again, the thing that drove me the nuts, the most crazy is like, sometimes they would say, well, what happened here? And she'd say, oh, well, I don't know what happened. That could have been me or an accident. I think she killed every one of those kids, but just kept saying, I'm not sure. I really do. There was a Dr. Joseph Spellman would finally come about, and he became very interested in crib deaths and dispelling them to try to help. You know, he was interested to try to stop SIDS, you know, sudden infant death syndrome. I mean, I remember being a young mother, and you're terrified of that. I mean, at the time they said to lay them on their back, and that's what I did, and I'm knock on wood, I never had even an issue. That is a scary thing. I don't wish that upon anyone. A lot of people thought that Marie was slow or maybe had a hyperthyroid because of the way she talked. After yet another crib death, you know, wink wink, and I'm not downplaying it, it's just unbelievable. Sun Life Insurance paid $1,200 on a policy that Arthur had taken out on Constance, and they would go shopping and buy a new living room suite with this money. So, I mean, this was just going on and on and on. And as a result, like I said, what you do eventually shows up on your face. In 1959, Arthur and Marie's family gathered in St. Hugh's Church to witness them renew their marriage vows. The years had not been kind to Marie, who now had a haunted look in her eyes and was white as a ghost. And you can see this in pictures on the internet. Look up Marie now. You can see, oh my God, in one mugshot, she is terrifying looking. Absolutely terrifying. Her once beautiful blonde hair was now greasy, brown, and unwashed. They watched the oddly matched couple exchange vows, and she had just turned 30 at this time. They looked 20 years older than their years. The one thing that made them very uncomfortable, and this reminds me of Rosemary's Baby a little bit, Marie's growing belly made everyone slightly uncomfortable. It reminds me of the scene in Rosemary's Baby where Guy and Rosemary, when he knows that the devil's, you know, because they had her have sex with the devil, which is a terrifying scene. This is really happening. He knows that's the devil's baby. So she feels the baby kick, and she puts Guy, the husband's hand there, and he like pulls it away real quick. It's a like darkly comic moment because Guy's like, you know, you can tell he's horrified. That's what this reminds me of. Her standing there. I mean, because she's, you know, growing belly. There's six childs on the way. Oh, my God. And I believe one of them does last more than six. On August 24th, 1959, Marie's sixth baby, Leticia, was stillborn at 39 weeks. All right, so she gets pregnant again, 62. Marie Leno was born June 19, 1962. And Marie suffered severe vascular collapse and anemia. The baby was under observation for a month. And even to this new Dr. Gangemi, who was her obstetrician at the time, she was highly nervous and excitable, but surprisingly unemotional about the deaths of her children. She would complain about the baby all the time and say she could not take the constant crying. She was a blank person. I wanted to send her to a psychiatrist, but her family doctor refused. During her short life, Linda Harris, who had been author's original friend, formed a great attachment to this beautifully plump, blue-eyed baby, finding her a picture of health and very bright. When she was 6 weeks old, author took out a $1,250 life insurance policy and another one on Marie 2 months later. Okay, so two different ones. He also took out three separate life insurance policies on his ailing mother. That Christmas, Mary Lee became only the second no baby to live through the festive season. Plunging himself into the Christmas spirit, author had bought like a tree and everything and fussing over him. And then there she goes. In 1998, Marie Noe said she no longer remembered about Mary Lee and if she had harmed her. I left the room for a few minutes, and when I came back, she was gasping for breath and turning blue. So I called the telephone operator and tell her to connect me with the police. They told me they would send someone right away. Then she called author and told him the tragic news. I mean, I do think she killed every one of them. I really do. They said she was like a zombie. One baby lived to be 6 months. I mean, and at one point, it had only been in the neighborhood, confined to that neighborhood, where anybody knew anything about what was going on. Now that this was happening, like, all of Philadelphia knew. Like, it was just getting, you know, a little bit bigger and bigger and bigger. Yeah, see, they said, here's a lady who might have some genetic defect that explains SIDS. So everyone wanted to, like, unlock the secret, but unfortunately, it wasn't meant to be. And as time wore on, they realized that, you know, I mean, outside of Marino, they realized that SIDS was just a freak accident here and there. It wasn't a genetic, you know, mutation. It wasn't, you know, a family would rarely have two SIDS deaths. And here, this lady has eight. I guess two were stillbirths. That is really sick. So, I mean, one of them lived to be like 7 months. So she killed a baby that was 7 months old. I mean, not that it's good they went 2 weeks. I just cannot get over it. On June 28, 1963, Marie went into premature labor. She gave birth to a 5.5-pound girl by C-section. I mean, Life magazine did interviews with her, Philadelphia Inquirer, but they were always cold about it, like, especially Marie. Like, there was no, you know, like, the lady from, okay, so there was a Dr. Molly DePenne wanted to interview her. I believe this was for Life magazine or around that time. And she just wanted to know, like, about the story. They were trying to figure things out, like possibly get to this genetic mutation for SIDS. And instead, she said, when I interviewed her, it was different with her. Like, in every other case, the mothers are like haunted, saying, what did I do wrong? They can't forgive themselves. You know, and instead with Marie, she said there was no tears, nothing. She was perfectly placid and she just sat on a rocking chair and casually talked about the deaths of her seven children as if she was talking about the weather. Elizabeth Noe, their mother-in-law was dying in an old people's home in early 1964 when Marie became pregnant again. Dr. Gangemi, who was secretly concerned about this at this point, said he thought Marie was schizophrenic, possibly psychotic, but what could she do except sit back and let fate take its course? When Marie was 8 months pregnant, Dr. Gangemi put her under hypnosis, trying to get her self-confidence up, so she would remain calm when the baby became cranky. He did want to ask her while she was under hypnosis if she ever killed her kids, but he said, I didn't want it to interfere with any court case that might come up. I mean, they were already thinking of court cases even back then. So, because you can't elicit a confession under hypnosis. He did get her into self-hypnosis, which she used till the day she died, actually. Catherine Ellen was born by C-section December 3rd, 1964. And she lasted a very long time. Like 9 months, I believe. I mean, it just sucks. Like, that's it. Kathy was the one that lasted the longest. And then she killed her too. Wow. When the doctor asked if I could, okay, this is what happened. I ran to the nose home and Marie was home with Catherine. I remember Catherine wasn't awake. I don't remember her being blue, so that I felt she might be alive. She bundled her young son, Nicholas, who was one of Mrs. Maxie Mewick. This was one of her neighbors. Bundled her young son, Nicholas, who was one of Kathy's playmates, into the car and drove to Episcopal Hospital. Marie holding her daughter in the front seat. It took 20 minutes to reach the hospital due to the heavy morning traffic. And throughout the nightmare, Mrs. Maximewick kept reassuring Marie everything would be all right. At 11:05, Marie brought Kathy wearing pink overalls and a white shirt into the emergency room and told doctors that the baby was not breathing. A Dr. Jacobs, who was on duty, examined Kathy and found no vital signs, so he immediately administered adrenaline straight to her heart. At 11:20, Dr. Jacobs pronounced Kathy dead, noting no obvious physical injuries. A few minutes later, Marie telephones Dr. Gigemi with the grim news. Marie DiTilio took the call, immediately transferring it to the doctor, become visibly angry on hearing Marie's explanation. As he slowly put down the phone, he looked as pale as a sheet and said, "Get me the police. The no baby died." When DiTilio asked him if he could do anything, he walked straight back in the office. "No, I'll take care of this myself," he said sternly. A few minutes later, DiTilio went into his office and Dr. Gigemi said sadly, "There was nothing wrong with that baby. We will never discuss it again." DiTilio would tell detective. "We never discussed it again," DiTilio said to detectives in 1998. He just said that one thing. So that was during the trial. Now, later on, the guy who got the famous boy in the box case, Remington Bristow, he had made it his personal agenda to find out who the boy in the box was, which, shame, they're still going through DNA, they claim. But he decided that he would also investigate this case with Marino to find out what was going on. So at this point, she used to wring her hands a lot, Marino, especially during interviews, because a lot of people would interview about this situation. I mean, 8, 9, 10 kids are gone. She was 37, and at this point, they consider her too old to have babies. And they said they were going to ask their pastor, and Marie said they might not let us have one on account of so many deaths. Catherine was like 7 months old. And the doctor thinks, their doctor thinks that she loved the attention. She loved Life magazine. She loved the attention on her. Like Munchausen's by proxy, in a way. I mean, it was a shame because I don't know. I don't know how much author's involvement was. he had to know deep inside that Marie was behind it. But being that she was the first person that paid attention to him, and, you know, I just, he stood by her till the very end. They had help with priests. They had help. Many people tried to help them. Wow. So, God, there's pictures of these babies. It's so unbelievable. They have pictures to shame. These pictures are amazing. One of the pictures, it's haunting. It's a picture of Marino with Arthur standing behind her. And it says, Arthur Marino at their Kensington home in January 1998. 3 months after this picture was taken, Marie would finally confess to killing 8 of her 10 children. And I wonder why she finally confessed to it. They make a pilgrimage to New Cathedral Cemetery, where the final remains of their babies lie. They would often go. They spent their final days in their rundown house in Kensington. I think it was on American Street. And the conditions of Marie's bail meant she could never step outside without permission from the police. After Marie's arrest for murder, Arthur No went to pieces and contemplated buying a gun to kill himself. He would just as soon know none of this happened. I mean, this is heavily, heavily detailed about the actual, Arthur Joseph No was born at St. Joseph Hospital Friday, July 28, 1967, a battery of doctors were there to make sure nothing went wrong. It was a difficult birth by cesarean section because Marino's uterine wall ruptured. Dr. Salvatore Cusinata said this might happen. I'm going to have to perform a severe hysterectomy on her. He became so concerned about Marie's state of mind that he begged her to stop having children after Kathy's death. But, I mean, your hands are tied. There was no complications, and this baby died. Except this time, on the report, it said, possible attempted suffocation was written. After all of these deaths, and one after another, finally, it was Mary Lee No who lasted the longest. June 19th, 1962 to January 4th, 1963. Interestingly, Kate, now they went through, you know, Life magazine interviewed them. Their neighbors always were suspicious. They had friends stop talking to them. His mother died she only seen like maybe the first couple, and she was so sick by that point. Interest kind of died, and then interest in the case was renewed after the publication of the 1997 books, Death of Innocence, about a New York woman, Juanetta Hoyt, and an investigative article, Cradle to Grave, by Stephen Fried, I think it's Fried, appeared in the April 1998 issue of Philadelphia Magazine. He was incredibly suspicious. He's an excellent writer who had written about Gia. So he had turned over his investigation results to the Philadelphia police in March 1998. Police questioned her, and No admitted to suffocating 4 of her children. She stated that she could not remember what happened to the other 4 children. She was then charged with first-degree murder in August 1998. A plea agreement was reached in which No admitted to 8 counts of second-degree murder, and she was sentenced in June 1999 to 20 years of probation with the last 5 years under house arrest. As a condition of her plea agreement, No agreed to psychiatric study in hopes of identifying what caused her to kill her children. In September 2001, a study was filed with the court which stated No had a mixed personality disorder with avoidant, dependent, narcissistic, histrionic, borderline, paranoid, and antisocial features. Again, Cradle to the Grave by John Glatt. It's a very good book about the situation. She was featured in Endangered Death, Pennsylvania Woman Who Kill, The Crime Buff's Guide to Outlaw Pennsylvania by Ron Franskill and Karen Valentine, and The Life You Longed For, a novel by Mary Beth Fisher, which is fictional, also mentioned in the No Murders. Now, she must have glorified in this, you know, attention, but I don't think, you know, I think in the end, I just, how can you have a good life if all this stuff's going on? I mean, I would hope she felt some good. I don't know. I really don't. It seems like she had a lot of issues. And of course, you know, author, he seemed very meek and timid. Marie's confession was sent to D.A. Lynn Abraham's office for review, and she would decide whether to prosecute, which she did. It was leaked to the Philadelphia Inquirer. And people just went nuts. Defense lawyer David Rubenstein agreed to take the high-profile case for nothing. I called a press conference and said there's absolutely no evidence of wrongdoing. We're trying to resurrect a 50-year-old case, said Lynn Abraham at the time. Nobody knew about this case. It was off the charts. And it was. I mean, this is really bad. Marie No had very little emotion, even during questioning. I'll say a little bit of the interview. I won't go through the whole thing. The police finally interviewed her because Stephen Fried had given all his research to the police. The police got Lynn Abraham involved, and the detectives sat down with her, and this is what she said. Now, he introduced himself. She said, you know, he read her rights. He said all the kids' names. I've been Mirandized before, back after the last child passed away. That was author Joseph No. They gave me a polygraph, too. Are you under the presence of drugs or alcohol? No. Are you under the presence for medical treatment? Just for diabetes. Have you been treated for a mental condition? No, I haven't. What was the last grade you completed in school? Yeah, blah, blah, blah. Marie, we're going to ask you to recall the circumstances of each of your children's death, beginning with the first death, that of Richard Allen No, on 4-7-49. Is that okay with you? Yes, I'll start at the beginning. Richard was born on March 7, 1949. He was very sickly after he came home from the hospital. He was throwing up and he had loose bowels. At first, I thought it might have been colic, and it came home from the hospital. He had been throwing up and he had loose bowels. At first, I thought it might have been colic, and my sister Frances thought it might have been colic too. She came around to see what she could do, and she told me that if I keep his belly warm, it might help. After 10 days stay in the hospital at Temple, Richard came home. I took him back to Temple because he was throwing up. They didn't know what to do. The next couple of days, you know, back and forth to St. Chris, and the doctor examined him and decided to keep him. He was only gone for a few days, and he was always crying. He couldn't tell me what was bothering. He just kept crying. The day that he died, I bathed him and put him in his night clothes. I was going to put him down for bed. I put him on his belly instead of his back, and there was a pillow under his face. He was lying face down. Then I took my hand and pressed his hand down onto the pillow until he stopped moving. After this, I went and laid down a couple of hours later. My husband, Art, came home from work. He was working the 3 to 12 a.m. shift. When Art came home, he found Richard in the bassinet. Art wanted to hold Richard, and he picked him up and found him cold. And I told Art that he was sound asleep a minute ago, but I knew that wasn't true. We wrapped him and went to Episcopal, and he did what he could. Murray, is there anything else you can recall? No. What about Elizabeth? She was born on September 8, 1950, and I was taking her to a pediatrician at Jay and Erie because my husband had Blue Cross back then. Elizabeth was born healthy, and she was pretty good until she got a cold. Then she got cranky. I was working then at a ribbon factory at 8th and Allegheny, and my sister-in-law would watch Elizabeth while I was working. It was a little too much on me working full-time and taking care of a baby, so I quit the job to stay here. When Elizabeth caught a cold, she ended up with a high fever, 105 degrees, so I took her to Dr. Schaefer, and she got better. About 2 or 3 weeks after this is when she died. She was in the bassinet. I put her on her back, and I took a pillow from the bed and put the pillow over her face and suffocated her. She was fussing. Elizabeth was a lot stronger than Richard, and she was fighting. I held the pillow over her face until she stopped moving. After that, I laid down on the sofa, and about a half hour later, my brother-in-law, Charles Noe, came over. He found her in the bassinet, and he said something was wrong. I went over, put my hand on her, and she felt cold. I told Charles to call the police, and they came in no time. The rescue squad came too, and they told me she was dead, but they had her taken to the hospital to make it legal. They took her to Episcopal. Marie, do you recall what happened after Elizabeth died? And on she goes. If you want to read this, I strongly recommend you get the book Cradle of Death by John Glatt, because it really does go through every single baby, and it's time and time again. It's just the names, dates, and how she suffocated them again and again. A few she says, I can't remember if I heard them or not, like with Arthur Joseph. She was always alone when the babies died. Pretty much she, oh, then she says some, don't tell my husband what I told you, she whispered to detectives. I mean, the confession was leaked to the Philadelphia Inquirer, and they ran it, and people just couldn't get over it. The lawyers came and told her to stop talking to the media. I mean, people would come. A family kind of always came to her defense. An author never pulled away from her. I guess you won't be home for your birthday, author said sadly to his wife. And she was booked on 8 charges of the first degree murder. She slowly turned to give Arthur one last parting look, but there was nothing behind those washed out blue eyes. So, you know, it was back and forth, but all in all, she was a very sick woman. It's just an out-and-out shame all around. She contemplated suicide. But you know what? Did she contemplate suicide because she was sorry about what she had done or because she got caught? And this is what a forensic pathologist, Dr. Linda Norton, had told about Arthur, because he never really could deal with it. And it says, yes, she was a serial killer. It's a type of denial. The spouse wants to believe in this person so much that they've come to depend upon, that they're willing to leave their common sense behind and simply believe. It doesn't make any difference how obvious it may be to other people. It's like, I'm not going to believe it because I don't want to. He even asked the detective if he thought she really killed his children. But 50 years of marriage had left him so dependent on Marie and so scared of losing her. He would never challenge her. He would have to be alone. Their house on North American Street became their prison. So, Criminal Justice Center, it was a 2-day hearing. She underwent a psychiatric examination to see if she could withstand trial. The next 2.5 hours, she discussed the deaths of her children. She enjoyed being the center of attention, even during this way. Tears welled in her eyes as she told doctors how she would resort to anything to save her marriage. I would lie like a log if I had to. If I had to, I would say something to those kids to stay out of jail. They had me in such a complexing situation, I'd say anything to get the devil out of the room. But when they read the confession, they said it was out without prompting or prodding. So she agreed. And she just couldn't remember some specifics about certain deaths. Although she claimed in 1949 that she had been raped by a black man, she no longer claimed to remember his race. And the second attack, she had now said there was no sexual contact with the intruder who bound her with author's ties and left her helpless. She's apparently a fairly poor historian, Dr. Sadoff wrote in his report. This is therefore an inconsistency in her memory pattern. She said she had been a sickly child, and she also said, you didn't have the kind of life I had. She was trying to get sympathy. It's sad, man. It really is. On Monday, June 28, 1999, Marino pleaded guilty to 8 counts of second-degree murder of her children under the 1939 Pennsylvania Penal Code. Her dramatic plea bargain came months after delicate negotiations between her lawyer, David Rudenstein, and the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office. She had been using a cane, and the electronic monitoring bracelet was around her ankle. Standing between her husband and sister, Anne Marino finally admitted publicly that she had systematically murdered her 8 children in cold blood. She was shaking like a leaf. We all thought she was going to collapse, said her sister. Standing next to his wife, Arthur now looked like a beaten man, his head slumped in his hands. He grimaced as if in pain when Marie admitted to the guilty repeated acts of infanticide, or killing my children. There was little emotion in her voice as she answered each of Common Pleas Court Judge William Mazzola's questions. He placed her under 20 months probation on condition that she serve the first 5 years under house arrest wearing her monitoring bracelet. She was also ordered to undergo psychiatric evaluations. I agree. When you kill infants, when you kill your kids, Dr. Stuart Ash, who studied the Marino case, had been asked to provide expert opinion. He dismissed the idea that Marie's inhumane experiences could ever benefit the medical community. It doesn't make sense. Marino killed her babies in order to get other people involved with her. You cannot instruct mothers to not be sick like that. He believes that serial baby killers like Marino are in a class of their own. He differentiates them from mothers who kill one baby in a postpartum depression and even one suffering from Munchausen by proxy. These are schizoids who are emotionally severed from society, narcissistic, self-involved, and untreatable, he explains. They can't be approached in psychotherapy because they can't relate to a therapist. There isn't medication for what they have. Okay, so that's the difference between her and Andrea Yates. Andrea Yates, they feel was treatable. I have to agree. Marino was a psychotic wacko. I mean, she was just nuts from the get-go. I do believe that. Wow. She did it without justification, without mitigation, without excuse. Although there was an outrage that Lynn Abraham had settled for such apparent lenient sentence, District Attorney Charles Gallagher said it was humane and finally brought closure to a case after so many years. We didn't have the strongest case. You're not going to get this baby's back, but maybe we'll learn why she did it. Maybe after a long series of treatment, we'll get to the bottom of it, which is very important. Outside the court, a crestfallen Arthur now waved an unlit cigarette. A reporter is saying no comment. Don't think I'm mean, but I've had enough. I feel bad for Arthur. I do. Damn. And they lived together. They were together till the end. He never left her. Arthur's still behind her. He still believes in her innocence because that's all he had. She's innocent, her sister said. Marie is a very mild person, a caring person who never raised her voice or got into any trouble. They had no money to pay for a long trial. Her lawyer told her that it would only, the only way she could make peace. So they think, her sister said it was a false confession. Now, as long as they live, Marie and Arthur Noe will be locked together in a desperate codependency with its own warped rules. Marie can never dare admit that she killed the children to Arthur, who can in turn never kill her, accuse her. That's a shame. That really is. It is one of the most bizarre cases. I have never read a case quite like this. That is one freaky ass story. Again, John Glatt wrote Cradle of Death. It's a fascinating book. It's very, very good, and it really explains many, many details that I couldn't get to. I had always thought that this was a strange case, and I wasn't going to do it for the longest time because I knew it was going to be one long story. I knew that. But it's a Philadelphia case, and it's a really crazy case. So I did it. Marino is done now. Next episode will be about the tragedy that is befalling these ATV and dirt bike riders. I just don't understand. I mean, we will be talking to a mother who lost her son in a tragic dirt bike accident. And it really is, it's a tragedy. And it shouldn't have happened, and it could have been avoided. So with that, this is Debbie Q with The Right Shoe, and I'll see you next time, guys. God, I reached the end. What do you do after fucking Philadelphia?